We are going to look at the origins of the women's self-defense movement this hour with the author of the book, Her Own Hero. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. The women's movement in the 1900s sought equal opportunity for the sexes, and our guest says the same values that earned women the right to vote motivated them to develop self-defense skills. And we will talk about that motivation. We will talk about why it was so difficult for women to gain the right to self-defense. We'll talk about how the self-defense movement evolved. Maybe some about how it what it's like today. Is anyone taking a self-defense class right now? Why? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let me welcome our guest. Wendy Rouse is the author of the book, Her Own Hero, The Origins of the Women's Self-Defense Movement. She's a faculty member at San Jose State University. Her research focuses on immigrant women, children, and families in the Progressive Era. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks a lot for being with us. So why did women, especially in the mid-1800s, feel they needed self-defense?
Well, I think the reasons that women started training in self-defense back then are pretty similar to the reasons that women really sign up for self-defense classes today. Some people signed up literally just to get in shape, to improve their physical health. And others were really specifically looking for the techniques that they needed to learn in order to protect themselves in case they were attacked on the street.
Yeah.
So pretty similar.
So I guess I'm thinking, wow, what was it really that dangerous to walk on the streets in the mid-1800s?
Yes. There was a lot of danger. There was a lot of the same issues that women face today. And there's also a lot of fear about the potential for danger that maybe motivated them as well. I found that a lot of women decided to sign up for a self-defense class because they had encountered violence on the street or harassment, or someone that they knew had encountered some sort of violence. And this wasn't just on the street either. This was, in the workplace. But women walking to work would describe, around the early turn of the century, they would describe being ogled and catcalled. Some women said that men would kind of attack them on the cable cars, either grab them inappropriately or say something inappropriate to them or rub up against them. And so they were really concerned with this. They actually had a slang term back then to describe these men. They called them mashers. And a masher was someone who basically verbally or physically made unwanted advances toward women. And so they saw this as really problematic and something that the police officers should take seriously.
Yeah, were the mashers taken seriously?
If women could complain to a police officer, could find a police officer, some cities did pass laws that made this illegal. And so the individual could be cited, fined, or even put in jail for a short period of time. But it was difficult to find a police officer nearby right when this incident maybe was occurring. But they did, most cities did pass some sort of ordinance against this behavior.
Yeah. So maybe tell us how did this start then? After the women got tired of the mashers, what happened?
Well, I think that women began to sign up for self-defense classes in part because boxing and jiu-jitsu had become very popular among middle and upper class men and women as a sport. Boxing was taken up in colleges among men as an activity, kind of light sparring, not really the competition, prize fighting type of brutal battles, but more as a sport. And jiu-jitsu had taken on quite a bit of popularity as Americans became more interested in Japanese culture. And Japanese instructors came over and started teaching jiu-jitsu techniques to a prominent individual. Even Teddy Roosevelt began training in jiu-jitsu. And so it kind of became this idea of kind of popular fad, like we could learn these techniques. And It took off in women's colleges to even dabble a little bit in boxing and jiu-jitsu. And eventually people realized that this was something that could be very useful to these women who were going out to work for the first time and experiencing kind of some of the great freedoms that women in the late 19th century were experiencing for the first time, going to school and entering into professions and jobs, that boxing and jiu-jitsu could really have benefits in helping to protect themselves from the type of violence they were describing.
So just to clarify, so these activities were around, but it was mainly for recreational or fitness purposes.
Yeah, recreation had athletics of all types had really become really popular in the late 19th century, especially, like I said, among middle and upper class women, because there was this concern that everybody needed to be fit, they needed to be healthy, and so boxing and jiu-jitsu had kind of taken on that status as just another way for people to improve their health.
Yeah. So, but you also write that that denial was rampant among mostly men who argued that violence against women was not a big problem, and there was it was a struggle for women to take these self-defense classes.
Yeah, there was quite a bit of denial, as you mentioned, kind of a tendency to say that the problem doesn't exist and to dismiss these claims that this was happening. There's also quite a lot of victim blaming. People would say that these women who were filing these complaints, that they weren't telling the truth, or that they were actually just flirting with the men and then trying to get back at them afterwards if they had been denied. They were told that their flashy clothing was causing the problem, or that they were inappropriately looking at these men and baiting them. And women were basically told, if you're going to be out in public, you need to avoid eye contact. You need to not talk to anybody. And if you do, then you're essentially asking for it. And these women were told that maybe they shouldn't even be out on the street, that maybe they should be at home. And if they absolutely have to go out in public, that they should have somebody with them, a male relative or friend accompanying them, to sort of be their protector.
You know, it's interesting. We still hear that today. In fact, very, very recently, a local police department put out some guidelines after there were a number of attempted or sexual assaults on campus, and said, hey, don't walk alone, and don't do this, and don't do that. And it caused an outcry because it was almost blaming the victim.
Yeah, and it's also kind of implying that women don't belong in public space, that they don't have the right to be there. And I think this idea, this is probably what most surprised me in my research, is that feminists at the time, in the early 1900s, were challenging this notion that men were women's natural protectors, because this was an idea that was pretty popularly accepted at the time. But feminists were challenging that, and they were saying, well, if men are women's natural protectors, why was so much violence being perpetuated by men at women? So they started to question this whole notion of the natural protector, and they argued instead that women, by necessity, needed to learn to defend themselves and each other, because oftentimes the violence was perpetuated at them by men, and not on the streets, by men in their own homes.
Oh, yeah.
It was really shocking to me that these ideas were being brought up as early as the turn of the century, because we know that this was a constant theme in the women's rights movement of the 60s and the 70s and today.
Yeah. And I read about, I don't remember her name, but she was a physician who argued against, hey, you're telling me I can't go out alone at night. What if I have a medical emergency I need to attend to? I have to go out alone at night.
Yes, there were several professional women that I came across who that's exactly the point that they were making, is that in theory we could all stay at home or only go out when protected, but in reality they have jobs to do. They have to get to work. In this case, this woman was a doctor, and she was saying that she gets calls in the middle of the night to help deliver babies, and there were times that just she absolutely had to be out. And then she was actually at that point calling on the police to at least respond to these concerns of women that they were being harassed on the street.
Yeah. And eventually, the men, I guess, agreed to the need for self-defense and agreed that violence was occurring against women outside of the home and probably inside the home, too. But they were looking at that this was not being done by the white men in the community. Talk some about that.
Yeah, I think most of the discussions about harassment against women or violence against women were focused on these stranger attacks. And these discussions really kind of tried to deflect blame on sort of a non-white other. And it was fueled by racism and xenophobia. Black men were depicted as rapists and Asian immigrant men as sexual predators. And then these new immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe were seen as sex traffickers. And white women, of course, were then depicted as their innocent victim, and their bodies were being endangered by these vicious foreigners. And so that kind of justified the self-defense training in the eyes of many white men. But it's kind of ironic because I found that overwhelmingly the statistics were proving that native-born white men were the primary perpetrators of violence against women on the street.
So when did the self-defense movement really take hold?
Well, it looks to me like it was around 1900. Boxing had taken off in the 1890s among the popular classes. And then around 1904 is right around when jiu-jitsu started to become very popular. That's when Teddy Roosevelt started training in it. And there was a lot of articles in the newspaper about his training. So it looks like around 1900 and definitely by 1910 and by 1917, you're seeing a lot of it discussed in the newspaper when actual photos of women in these self-defense classes.
And did many women take these self-defense classes?
It was mostly middle and upper class women who could afford to either pay instructors for private lessons or to pay an instructor to come and talk to their women's group or their women's club. So it was definitely really among primarily a white upper middle class movement. But they began to see this as something that they felt that all women should take, and they kind of took on this kind of attitude that it was their duty to save other women as well from this. And so they tended to, you would have very wealthy women sponsoring self-defense classes for the working girl to try to help women, all women, learn self-defense. But it was rooted in these very racial and class notions of women's kind of status in society, this white woman's status in society.
We're talking with Wendy Rouse. She is the author of Her Own Hero, The Origins of the Women's Self-Defense Movement. We welcome your questions. We welcome your own experiences. We wonder what you think about the women's self-defense movement today. Have you taken a self-defense class? How did you feel about that afterwards? What do you think about the idea of women's self-defense? Is it different than self-defense? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about the origins of the women's self-defense movement, talking some about the evolution of the women's self-defense movement, and maybe we'll get into a little bit more some parallels that still exist today. And we welcome your experiences and your questions for our guest, Wendy Rouse, author of Her Own Hero. We will welcome those questions and experiences at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on Facebook. We have a new Facebook page. The Joy Cardine Show Facebook page is phasing out as I'm retiring at the end of the month, the end of next week. So please go to the Ideas Network Facebook page and like that. That's where you will find our talk show content now and in the future, the Ideas Network Facebook page. Wendy, you argue that the same values that earned women the right to vote motivated them to develop self-defense skills. Talk some about how women's self-defense played into the fight to gain the right to vote.
Sure. Women were obviously organizing for the right to vote in the United States and also in England at the time. And so their self-defense training really took on political meaning. This is probably the best example of this is in England, where suffragists were facing very violent anti-suffrage crowd. People who objected to women having the right to vote actually kind of organized mobs. They threw rotten fruit at the women. They threw bottles, urine-soaked rags. I mean, it was pretty hostile, the circumstances that these women were facing. And they were physically accosted at times by these anti-suffragists. So English suffragists actually formed secret clubs to train in self-defense, just as jiu-jitsu and boxing had become popular in the U.S. Jiu-jitsu especially was really popular in England among the upper classes. So these English suffragists actually formed these like secret societies that were training in jiu-jitsu. And although it didn't take off to the same extent among suffragists in America, there was a similar pattern that happened here. But these militant suffragists, they were perceived as really stretching the boundaries of what was acceptable feminine behavior. And in some ways, they were seen as too masculine and a danger to society, if not in their actual training in self-defense, then in their demands for equality. So it kind of took on this double meaning for them.
Yeah. So, we'll talk some more about how people opposed to women's equal rights and women's self-defense attacked the femininity of those who were involved in the movement. How did they do that?
Well, they were afraid in some ways that women training in any kind of athletics, but especially in self-defense, that their bodies would physically kind of morph and become more masculine. So that was part of it. And I think the bigger concern was that women would begin to demand more of the rights that men had and want to be seen on the same plane of equality as men. And so you see this reflected in a lot of the anti-suffragist writings, even in popular images and cartoons that were drawn to try to attack the suffragists, that they were essentially trying to become men, to wear the pants, literally. And so it was very much an attack on their desire to achieve political and social equality.
Interesting. There's another parallel today. I mean, well, at least a couple of decades ago when I was working out a little bit more maybe than I am now, there was a big fear. If you're working out, you're going to develop these masculine muscles and you don't want to do that. And it was perceived as, you don't want to look like a man, so don't train in bodylifting or weightlifting.
Yeah, and I think many women have kind of internalized this sort of sexist attitude about women's bodies and how they should look, and this desire to not be too, to be strong and healthy enough, but not be too strong or too healthy and to that extreme.
Did women at the turn of the 20th century train in self-defense to prove a feminist point?
I think so. Even if they had not intentionally gone into the training with that intent, many of them left the training with a broader sense of empowerment, not just physically, but politically, recognizing that what they were doing was essentially taking back their own power as individuals and, in essence, as women. So, again, I don't think most women went into the training thinking, I'm doing something, to advance the rights of women, or I'm proving a political point. But by the time that they finished their training or stopped training, they really recognized that, wow, I've participated in this movement that's bigger than just me.
We are talking with Wendy Rouse. She is the author of Her Own Hero, The Origins of the Women's Self-Defense Movement. And Wendy, you were a self-defense instructor for many years. You say you heard some of the same themes then as you found in your research. Talk some about that.
Yeah, I had actually started training in martial arts when I was a young kid. I was 10 years old when I started taking karate classes. And I studied karate throughout high school, and even in college I took a a karate class, and I eventually passed into the rank of instructor and started teaching self-defense classes. And that's part of what kind of drew me into this research, too. I was trained as a historian and never really thought of doing research on this topic, but we had always learned that our instructors, our female instructors, were the first women to study self-defense or to study martial arts, and that they were the pioneers. So these were the women of the 70s and the 80s. So when I was doing research on another topic for my dissertation in history, I came across these images in the newspaper of women studying boxing and jiu-jitsu, and I was shocked because it really challenged that narrative that I had been taught, that women's self-defense training was a new thing, was a response. So that's what really pulled me into the research, because I had seen that before as a recent phenomenon. It turned out to be much deeper, so I wanted to know the history and the background of that. And then when I started researching it, that's when I started seeing the parallels that you mentioned between women's self-defense then and now, and a lot of the things that we had taught in our own self-defense classes, I started to see as echoing back to the points that the feminists were making at the turn of the century, this idea of women's right to exist in public space and, unfortunately, the need to physically claim that space.
Yeah. And I know, my husband was a black belt in some martial art, some form of karate, and he taught me a few moves just at my request. I never took a formal self-defense class in a setting at a facility. There was a self-defense movement in the home as well back then.
Well, yeah, there was. I think what started to happen is all this discussion about attacks on the city streets and attacks from strangers really let feminists start talking about violence against women, made it kind of acceptable. Newspaper reporters were actually reporting on the violence against women for the first time. And so this kind of opened up this very public discussion about, well, where do women face violence and where is this happening? And so a few really prominent feminists who had been delving into this issue for quite some time started to say that there was this more radical truth here than just the violence that women were facing on the streets. And they argued essentially that women were most at risk for violence, not from strangers, but actually from the men in their own homes. And this is really a controversial thing to say, so it was somewhat muted discussion at the time, but it was there. And so I kind of wanted to know about this as well. And an interesting story is I noticed in the newspapers at the time there's this crime spree in Chicago in 1905 and 1906, and the newspapers printed these horrific headlines of murders of women on the streets. And there was a lot of public attention and demand that the police crack down on crime, that women were being assaulted on the streets, and that women needed to study self-defense to protect themselves from these strangers who were posing this menace. So these newspaper articles were really playing into this concept of women's self-defense and the perpetuators of crime being really these sinister strangers that were preying on innocent women. So I was curious about the statistics because I knew what the feminists were saying at the time, that you know most women faced violence in their home and this was a bigger issue. So I looked at these cases. I actually looked at a five-year period, ending with that 1905 year that was highlighted so much in the papers. And I found there were 99 women murdered in Chicago during those years. And what I found when I looked at each individual case is that the vast majority, 85%, were actually killed by husbands, lovers, or male relatives.
Oh, that's horrible.
Yeah, and in the majority of the cases, they were actually killed at home. So these numbers were even higher than I could confirm, because some cases I didn't have the exact notion of who the perpetrator was.
Right, and so this is an example of why women needed self-defense, because they not only they might have faced a threat right in their own home, but I guess I was asking: were women taking? Were those men teaching the husbands or anybody else teaching the women to defend themselves in the home?
Yes, so just a lot of the self-defense instructors were boxing instructors. Women would go to them and say, we would gladly pay you for private instruction. So many boxing instructors realized that there was this demand for women who were scared of violence on the street to maybe be make it a little extra money on their part to train them in self-defense. So women, boxing instructors trained women, and some women, yes, they learned from their husbands, they learned from their brothers how to protect themselves, especially if they were concerned about their family members going out into the public realm and being in danger.
We are talking with Wendy Rouse, author of Her Own Hero, The Origins of the Women's Self-Defense Movement. And we welcome your questions or your own experiences for her. Do you teach self-defense? Do you take self-defense? Have you taken a self-defense class? Do you see parallels between then and now when it comes to the women's self-defense movement? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Do you think it's a good idea for a woman to take a self-defense class? Kara in Ashland is with us. Hi, Kara.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead.
I have a self-defense class. And
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand you, Kara. What did you say?
I said I have taken a self-defense class, and I'm very happy to hear you guys talking about the fact that violence against women is not just strangers. And in my self-defense class, we learned a lot of good things. But what we never talk about is when it's appropriate to respond. I feel like a lot of women have a very delayed physical response to aggression. So we have to have a fear of death or severe injury before society deems it appropriate for us to respond. Thank you.
Oh, interesting. Do you agree with that, Wendy?
Yeah, that's one of the things that modern self-defense classes can really help kind of women negotiate. There's something today called empowerment self-defense, which is really rooted in the feminist self-defense movement in the 60s and the 70s. And these courses really talk about not only the multiple sources of violence against women, but the multiple different options that women have in responding to different types of situations. Because oftentimes the violence isn't always the way it's portrayed on TV or in the movies, right? And there's a lot of boundary setting and verbal self-defense and psychological self-defense strategies that women learn in these classes that can help them determine the level of risk and the appropriate level of response as well.
Yeah. It's, yeah, it just so I it's interesting because she was saying that we take self defense, but yet we are not we're not sure if we should fight back until maybe it's too late.
Yes, and also I think that has roots in these kind of earlier objections to women being physically even active. Is this idea that should women even be allowed to defend themselves? I mean, if we go back to the mid-19th century, women were being told that they shouldn't even engage in any kind of physical activity, even running or any kind of sport, because it was dangerous to their bodies, that they could hurt their reproductive capabilities. And it took women doctors in the mid-1800s to say, no, women should be physically active, women should develop their muscles and develop their cardio health. And so there's always been this objection to women taking any kind of physical activity, and then that carried over into self-defense. Women, you know, it's dangerous for women to fight back. They might hurt themselves. And so women had to consistently say that they were physically capable of taking care of their health and then eventually of training in athletics and training in self-defense. So it really has been this constant battle to even prove that women have the right to fight back. So if women today feel that there's similar pressures against them saying that they shouldn't fight back or they don't have the right to fight back or feel guilty about fighting back, a lot of that has to do with the gender socialization that has tended to tell women that they, one, can't do it physically, and two, that they shouldn't do it because it's not very feminine.
Lynn in Eau Claire is with us. Hi, Lynn.
Good morning. In light of the last question, my question has changed to what from self-experience, I learned that sometimes women are further victimized for trying to protect themselves or for fighting off their attacker. And what are the statistics on that? And you know, I have a daughter. I have granddaughters. I want them safe, and I want them secure in knowing that if they are going to defend themselves, that they are not going to be further punished.
Oh, you mean, Lynn, and just I'm going to be blunt, that if someone fights back rather than submit,
yeah, the law,
they might
law
die.
Law went after me, not after my attacker. That's when we still live in a male-dominated society.
And I'm sure, Lynn, you said that the law will go after you and not your attacker?
It has happened where women have been further victimized when their attacker turns the table on them for defending themselves.
All right. I think I understand. And there's a number of different ways we can bring this up. And Lynn, I'm sorry for what you've been through, but I think it could be that somebody defending themselves. I think Lynn is saying that you could get in trouble for defending yourself if the attacker says she started it, or for that matter, if you try to defend yourself and just anger the attacker even more, and you end up getting hurt even more than you could have been, Wendy.
Yeah. Well, this is the issue, especially of being hurt even more if you fight back, has been studied by scholars, and what they found is statistically, you're more successful if you do try to fight back. And so self-defense advocates definitely recommend trying to fight back. But, of course, this is individual, and you have to take it case by case. And that's part of why empowerment self-defense training is really important, because they can show you a variety of options and strategies for trying to deal with different situations, because obviously it's going to depend on the individual and what's happening in the moment. But oftentimes you'll hear cases in the media of women fighting off attackers, and I think that kind of illustrates the success that self-defense classes have in helping women. So I don't know if I'm answering that question.
Yeah, I'm not sure you can answer the specific aspect that somehow the law will turn against the woman who's protecting herself rather than the attacker who is hurting her.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the statistics on that, but I think overall we have a problem in society with sexism and attitude, kind of backlash against women. I mean, even back in the period that I was studying and before 1920, you know, there's a lot of backlash against women who tried to speak out and just say that they were being harassed, even just saying that, hey, these people are physically harassing us on the subway. And there's a lot of kind of backlash against these women and a tendency to try to silence them from speaking out.
Yeah. Did you look into what was the defense called? Battered women's syndrome, when a woman might have actually shot and killed her attacker when he was not attacking her. And as a defense for the violence that has happened.
Right. I did not look into that. In the time period that I was studying, that was not something that was addressed really at the time. That's something that came in the 60s and 70s as a defense, and even into the 80s and 90s. And so most of my research is focused on that prior to 1920 era. But there were instances of women fighting back at that time against domestic violence, and then going to court and defending their actions by trying to set up this pattern of violence that they had experienced that had led them to the moment where they ultimately fought back and sometimes killed their husbands in the process.
We're talking with Wendy Rouse. She is the author of Her Own Hero, The Origins of the Women's Self-Defense Movement. talking about how self-defense, the self-defense movement started back at the turn of the century, and how it was linked to the fight for equal rights, including the right to vote. I'm wondering if you have any questions or thoughts about this. Our guest also says that women found empowerment in fighting gender expectations and discovered their own power. Wondering if you have discovered your own power as a woman. Do you take self-defense classes? Do you teach self-defense classes? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about women's self-defense with our guest, Wendy Rouse. She is the author of the book, Her Own Hero, The Origins of the Women's Self-Defense Movement. She's a faculty member at San Jose State University. Her research focuses on immigrant women, children, and families in the progressive era. And she found that the women's movement into the 1900s, while it was seeking equal opportunity for the sexes, also was the start of the self-defense movement. We're talking about that start, the evolution of it, parallels to today, wondering if you see those, wondering if how important self-defense is today, maybe, as compared to yesterday. Wendy, do a lot of women still take self-defense classes today? Is it something that, has come and gone?
I think more women are taking self-defense classes today than ever before. Although I have seen that it really is paralleling the waves of feminism. So like I said, I was studying the pre-1920 period, and that was kind of the first wave where you see a large number of women taking up self-defense, and then a much larger group of women in the 60s and 70s. And then there was a peak again in the 90s, and it seems that we're in yet another wave of self-defense classes, again, being quite popular.
Eileen in Sirona is with us. Hi, Eileen.
Hi, how are you?
Good. I understand you've taken self-defense.
I did. When I was a very young woman, I lived in Washington, D.C., and then while I was shopping on a weekend, I was attacked by a gentleman who ended up being put into jail because the next woman he attacked, he killed.
Oh, my gosh.
So that made such an impact on my life. I got married, moved to Chicago, and then when my children were growing up, I always had this desire not to be victimized like that again. So I found the local YMCA had a course in the 80s, and I took the course, and that was a life-changing event as well because I learned how to defend myself. From the time I would step out onto the street in public view, I was taught to walk with purpose and to walk with dignity and attitude so that I wouldn't appear to be weak or able to be victimized. They taught me my presentation as well as how to avoid and fight if someone tried to get me into a car, how to position yourself so that would never happen. They taught me skills as to how to behave in a bar if somebody were to approach me and try to snatch me. So it was a very effective course, and I ended up, I would go home and practice on my husband. He didn't care for that too much, but he really respected it, and I ended up putting both of my teenage daughters in the course after I finished it.
Yeah, because there's a lot more. You're saying there's a whole lot more to it than throwing somebody down to the ground.
Exactly. It's from the moment you step out of the room or however you act, especially in public. If my experience, my negative experience, was in public, and I never wanted to walk out the door again appearing to be someone who was weak or able to be victimized. Mm-hmm. And it gave me that. It gave me an ability to walk outside with purpose.
So it gave her courage, too, Wendy. Want to react to her story?
Yeah, and it's so similar to what women were describing 100 years ago who were studying self-defense. This, they didn't intentionally go into it necessarily, but they recognized that they were getting this sense of really empowerment that was developing in them about their abilities, kind of a sense of confidence and So there's a psychological element to the training, too, that just has benefits for women, even if they never encounter any kind of a situation where they have to defend themselves, that they're just developing this sense of themselves and of really taking that that knowledge that they have the right to protect themselves and to protect their bodies.
Eileen, thank you so much for calling. Here she enrolled her daughters into the classes as well. And presumably they got that same sense of empowerment from it. Is that where Her Own Hero, the title of the book, is that where that comes from?
Yeah, there was actually an image in the newspaper of a woman fighting back, and the title was Learn to Be Your Own Bodyguard. So I thought it was interesting that they were really taking on this perception that they were casting off this notion that they needed to be saved by someone else, that they could be their own heroes. And it's interesting, she was talking about training her daughters. There was a group of women in Washington, D.C., who knew that Teddy Roosevelt was training in jiu-jitsu, and they wanted to train in jiu-jitsu as well. And so these were wives of senators and representatives, and they started training in jiu-jitsu, and they brought their daughters. And so there's images of these young 10-year-old girls sitting on the jiu-jitsu mats and learning self-defense alongside these Japanese instructors who came to train Teddy Roosevelt.
Wow. Let's go to Taj in Monona, Iowa. Hi, Taj.
Hi. How are you?
I'm good. What is your story or question?
Oh, just my comment. I grew up taking martial arts from an early age, and I just, as a man, I strongly feel that women should be encouraged to enroll in self-defense, and not just reactively, but proactively. It's a good thing to do, and it builds confidence, and like your previous caller said, having that mentality and having that knowledge when you go out into the world and knowing how you're presenting yourself to the world, it has an impact, and, you know, just having that confidence could probably help you avoid situations where you would be targeted and abused.
Mm-hmm. Wendy, any thoughts?
Yeah, definitely looking at the, as you said, the kind of proactive approach to thinking about how to prepare yourself for a variety of potential situations. I think that's why empowerment self-defense is a good model, especially for young girls, if you want to sign up your daughters or someone you know for self-defense training. Empowerment self-defense really has roots in the feminist self-defense movement that I was studying in the early 20th century and even in the 60s and 70s. And they really talk about the proactive approaches and looking at the variety of strategies that women can use. It's a much broader type of self-defense course than just simply learning to kick and punch.
So you look for empowerment self-defense when you're in the Yellow Pages or what?
Yeah, empowerment self-defense courses is a specific type of course, and there's a certification process for those instructors through the National Women's Self-Defense Association, and I can send you more information on.
I'm sure there's probably a website somewhere that we can go to.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so based on your experience and your research, you are an advocate for women or young women in taking empowerment self-defense classes.
Yes, I mean, before I started doing research on this topic, I was a self-defense advocate, and I had recognized its own significance in my life for just developing confidence and self-esteem growing up as a young woman. And then when I started teaching it, seeing its impact on others. And I really didn't learn much about the empowerment model or the roots and the ties to feminism until I started doing the historical research on it. And that's when I realized that our training had much more significance beyond just the benefits for us as individuals, but really for women as a whole.
Rory in Chippewa Falls emails, when my daughter was 8, she took several months of karate lessons, then stopped. When she was 24, she was caring for a much larger man who was autistic. He became stressed and started to attack her. Without hurting him, she applied some compliance techniques that she had learned and calmed him down. So, I guess self-defense is more than a karate chop.
Yes, and it sounds like maybe she was learning some de-escalation strategies, which are also a big part of with a lot of the empowerment self-defense courses. And like I said, there's a variety of different self-defense techniques that have nothing to do with physically fighting back.
Jimmy on Facebook says, my wife started training in Brazilian jiu-jitsu last year and has never been happier. She's fit, more confident, and has made friends for life. Christine on Facebook says, in college in the 1970s, I joined the judo team. It did not help me get any dates, but I enjoyed my time on the team and the skills that I learned. Luckily, I have never had to use the skills for self-defense, but it did make me feel more confident. All right, so both of them feel more confident, Wendy, and that's a big part of it.
Yeah, that's the whole point.
Yeah,
and it's great to hear all the different varieties of martial arts that people have taken. I know Brazilian jiu-jitsu is really popular today, and it's also a good form of self-defense for women.
Yeah. So, what lessons should women, or people in general for that matter, now take from the struggles of women more than 100 years ago when it comes to, this self-defense?
Well, I think it's this whole idea that violence against women has been an issue for hundreds of years, and feminists have been raising this issue in a variety of ways, and obviously self-defense is only one response to this, but really the need to look at this issue and think about the deeper causes of violence against women and the variety of potential solutions to this beyond self-defense training. And I think it's interesting to know the history of women's self-defense, but to know that there's a lot more work to be done specifically in fighting violence against women.
Yeah. We still have a minute or so left. I think we have time for Amy in Milwaukee. Hi, Amy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yes, what's your story?
I'm really enjoying this. I took a self-defense class at my daughter's school last weekend, so this is very timely. And I left there feeling so empowered. And we were punching using the heels of our hand to hit these mats, and I just didn't even know I had the strength that I did. And I surprised myself. And I just thought when I left, I have a 5-year-old daughter, so she will take a class eventually. But I just think that in middle schools and high schools, we should be doing this for all girls and for all young women, because I just left feeling so good and so empowered. And I practice on my husband as well, and he's a little afraid of me now, but he's a lovely man, and he lets me practice. But one thing the instructor talked about was where we're equal as men, women. So the eyes, the throat, and, of course, the tomatoes, she called them.
the tomatoes.
we were taught to think about oranges, Coke can, tomato. Eyes are oranges, throat is Coke can. The nether regions is the tomatoes. So I left there with so many tools. It was a 2-hour class, and I'm an advocate, and I'm telling everyone about it. So
thank you so much, Amy. We have less than 30 seconds, but I'm so glad we got that call in, Wendy. Do you think this should be taught in schools?
Yes, I think so. I think all people should have the right to learn to defend themselves, and I think that's awesome that she got that sense of strength and empowerment, and that she can do it, and that's the whole point of women's self-defense.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Of course. Thank you.
Wendy Rouse, author of Her Own Hero, The Origins of the Women's Self-Defense Movement. Thanks to Keely Bultina for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
Policing is an issue that divides Americans. This week, we're taking a look at how police are trained through the eyes of the people who are just entering the force.
This unit.